All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is May 6th. Indeed, it is May 6th. Okay, got a couple of announcements. One announcement, the LRC is going to have some extended hours starting next week. It's going to be open until 11 p.m., and that's the bottom floor of the LLRC. The upstairs floor, which is the library, is still going to close at the usual time, which is 9 o'clock. Okay, so those are some extended hours if you want to use a computer over there or study with a group, something like that. That's good. I think that's the only announcement we have. Let's look at the schedule. All right, so here is the 6th. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We've got 5 lectures left, and so we're probably interested to find out what chapters are going to be on that last exam. All right, well, for sure, 13, 14, and 16, according to the study guides. And I will update the study guides and I'll tell you what parts of 18 will be there, but I would like to put something on the final because that was a weekly assignment for you to do, so I do want you to get some good course points for that other than the online quiz. And the diversification system will probably have time to maybe just go over one figure, and I'll show you what figure that is. So I went into study guides, and I noticed that some of these guides are not activated. As a matter of fact, there's one section here, there were no study guides activated for that last test. And so I activated some for you, so please get started on those. Nobody let me know that those were hidden. I didn't mean to keep those hidden for you. So please check that out. So that's the deal. So 13, 14, 16... and parts of 17, 18, and 20. Okay? Okay. So that will be on the last test. Last test is on Thursday, May 22nd. Then usual time. And it will be just like a regular test. So it won't be a two-hour test. It will be, what, a one-hour and 35-minute test or whatever, just like the other ones are. And I'll try to get here as soon as possible so you guys can get started. I will even kick that astronomy class out of here. Okay, any questions? Yes. Yeah, in the study guides. Yeah, so you know exactly what figures you should know, exactly what end of chapter questions I think are really important for you to know, and if there's any online questions in those example questions. Yes, I'll keep that. Just like that. And so then you'll have the good definition for what will be on the test, because now I can kind of see where we're going to end up in class. All right, so we were still talking about blood flow last time and blood vessels. Does anybody have any questions on blood flow, blood vessels? Almost didn't finish up, but we're going to finish up really fast today on that. No questions? All right, well, we left off at capillaries. And, of course, you have to know something about capillaries, like what is their functional significance? What's the significance of a capillary? Exchange takes place. That's right. Things can enter or leave the blood only through a capillary. If you have oxygen in an artery, and you have this artery in your heart, can your heart get oxygen from that artery? Can your heart get oxygen? It cannot, because the oxygen just can't get out. Right, only through a capillary. So that blood that's in that artery has to move into a capillary, and then it can release that oxygen to whatever tissue it is, including the heart, brain, kidney, whatever. Right, and maybe I mentioned this last time, maybe not, but the CPR regulations were rewritten a couple of years ago to take advantage of that fact. It used to be we would do a lot of respirations and chest compressions. Right, respirations to bring oxygen into somebody's lungs that wasn't breathing on their own. And the new regulations are fewer respirations and more chest compressions, because we realize that there still is a lot of oxygen in blood, in particular the arteries, and all we have to do is get that oxygenated blood in those arteries out to the tissues or primarily to the brain. Right, so it's more important to do chest compressions than it is to breathe for somebody. But of course you have to do both. All right, so capillaries are for exchange, and there's basically three different kinds of capillaries. I think we talked about these. Continuous capillary, these are the least leaky, and the endothelial cells are just a simple squamous epithelium. There are tight junctions between them. There are some small intercellular clefts, but they're not very large. And those clefts or channels are not big enough for cells like red blood cells, but only plasma can leak out through them. And probably even small enough to where proteins can't, maybe some really small proteins can, but not very much at all. But some tissues need to have even enhanced exchange. And so there's another kind of capillary called fenestrated. They have bigger spaces between the cells. We call it the spaces between the cells. We call it intercellular clefts, right? Or pores, usually even a cell, an endothelial cell can have a pore in it. And that's, you might want to think of that as a doorway or a window or something, and that's what this term comes from. All right, so a fenestrated capillary is very permeable. Find these in the kidneys. We're going to look at some kidneys before the class is over. And then discontinuous capillaries, these are very leaky. So we're going to find these in an organ, for instance, like the liver, where the blood actually drains out of the vascular system, flows around various cells of the liver for processing, and then flows back into a blood vessel. So discontinuous. Have large gaps within the endothelium. The intracellular clefts are very large, and the pores are very large as well. All right, so those are your capillaries. So we talked about arteries, talked about capillaries. What else should we look at? What's on your list of blood vessels that we should be looking at? Veins, yeah, veins. Okay, so let me do that. Nice. Okay, so here are some veins. Most of the blood in your body is contained in a vein. And that's because veins are very compliant. So what the heck does that mean? Well, that just means that they expand very easily and to a large extent when the pressure changes in them. So you should be able to tell me what is more compliant, a tire that you have on your car? Because when you pump air into it, the tire actually gets a little bit bigger, right? If you have a flat tire, there's no pressure in there, so the tire is compressed. You put some air in there, the pressure goes up, and the tire expands. So the tire is compliant when we change the pressure. All right. Or is a balloon more compliant? Which stretches more when you put some pressure in it? The balloon stretches a lot faster, right? So if you blow into a balloon, the balloon is going to expand. You probably couldn't expand the volume of a tire, right, if you had to blow with your own breath. Right, you need a pump to do that, a higher pressure pump. So a car tire is not compliant, but a balloon is. It will change volume with very small changes in pressure. So a balloon is a better model of what a vein looks like and how it behaves, not a car tire. All right, so by the time blood gets into a capillary or into a vein through a capillary, it only has about 2 millimeters of mercury pressure. And what's the highest pressure in an artery that you're aware of? Just tell me what the name is first. What's the name of high pressure? Yeah, systolic pressure. What's a good number for systolic pressure in terms of millimeters of mercury right here? Like 120. Yeah, it's higher in some people, but that would be hypertension. Right, so 120 over, there's a diastolic pressure too, over 80. Right, so 120 over 80 is a typical blood pressure, good healthy blood pressure in an artery. But let's look at these veins, only 2 millimeters of mercury. All right, so that's not very much pressure. Well, how does fluid move from one place to another? How does it flow? How does a fluid flow, whether it's a gas in the room or liquid in a tube? Right, and we wrote this out before. Right, blood flow, for instance, or air flow, or any kind of flow is going to be equal to two things. What are these two things? One thing is directly related, the other thing is inversely related. Flow is going to be equal to the pressure. Yep. Divided by the resistance. All right, so here I said the pressure is 2 millimeters of mercury. What does that mean for flow? That means blood hardly flows at all through a vein all by itself because the pressure in the right atrium is about zero, so that pressure gradient is very, very small. So how do you get blood back to your heart, for instance, from your big toe? When you're standing up. Might be easy to figure out how does it get back to the heart from your brain because your brain is way above your heart unless you're lying down. So how does blood get back to the heart if there's only 2 millimeters of mercury compared to what? 120 over 80. Right. By that pressure alone, it's insufficient to return blood to the heart. So We wouldn't last very long. There are some other kind of pumps besides the heart. And the two other kinds of pumps are what we call the respiratory pump, and the second one is the skeletal muscle pump. So when any skeletal muscle in your body is contracting, like my biceps right here, right, it gets bigger, it bulges, and it squeezes down on all of the nerves, all the arteries, and all the veins that are in that biceps brachii, right? And then the pressure goes from 2 millimeters of mercury to, well, I don't know if anybody's ever measured it, okay, but we could say maybe 60 or 70, or if I'm lifting a really heavy weight, it might get up to 100 millimeters of mercury. So that's a lot of pressure, and that vein is going, or the blood in that vein is going to want to squirt out of the muscle, back down to the periphery, or back to the heart, right? So it could go retrograde back to my hand, or antegrade to my heart, and which way do you think it goes? When I contract a muscle in some peripheral region of my body, maybe thigh muscles, calf muscles, right? It's pressurizing all that blood and veins, and which way does that blood go? Or maybe it could go in both directions. Here's your answer. And that's because it only goes in one direction. And that's because, just like the heart, veins have valves in them. Part of the endothelium of a vein produces these valves. So for instance, here we have a vein. The heart would be above it on this particular illustration, and this vein is between two muscles. And the pressure when these muscles are relaxed is about, what's the pressure in these vessels when the muscles are relaxed? What's the pressure in this blood, in this vein? Yeah, 2 millimeters of mercury, not enough to get it back to the heart, right? But we're going to use these muscles, and when we use them, they bulge up like this, squeezing this compartment so the pressure goes way up, which is a nice driving force for the blood in this region right here. And which way is it going to go? Toward the heart or back down into the periphery? It's going to go back to the heart because the valves only let it go in one direction. And that, of course, is true only if these valves are healthy and only if this vein is healthy. Sometimes veins do enlarge, they dilate pathologically, and this vein can be so big that the valve leaflets can no longer touch each other. So they're just going to flop back and forth, right? If a vein gets really, really big, like a varicose vein, then the valve leaflets can't touch each other, so that when a muscle contracts, blood is going to go in both directions, back to the heart, back down to the periphery. That's not very good, because blood is going to pool in the periphery when that happens. So that kind of vascular disease, like varicose veins, or there can be veins deep inside somebody's legs, for instance. If they're over-dilated, then blood is going to have a tendency just to pool in those veins. And what can you tell me about blood when it's not flowing? Something terrible happens to it. It clots. That's right. So when these veins are damaged, right, in people, whether varicose veins or other kinds of veins in a person's body, then that could be an area that generates blood clots. And if they float around in your body, they could go to the brain, cause a stroke, right? Because it's going to occlude a blood vessel. It could go to your heart, occlude a blood vessel in your heart, and that's called a heart attack. Yeah. So knowing something about these veins is really important. Okay, so that's the skeletal muscle pump. And what was the other pump that I mentioned? It's on this slide here too. Yeah, respiratory pump. Okay, well, fortunately, we have a vacuum cleaner in our thorax, right? And we know that because we inhale all the time, right? And that's acting like a vacuum cleaner. If we increase the size of our thorax, that decreases the pressure in our thoracic area, so air is going to rush into our lungs, right? But when we decrease the pressure in our thorax, not only does air run into our lungs, but fluids in other parts of our body get vacuumed right up into the thoracic cavity. And one of those fluids would be blood. So every time you inhale, okay, that's helping that pressure gradient, and that's actually drawing blood back to the heart, because your heart is where? Right inside the thoracic cavity. All right, so the respiratory pump and skeletal muscle pump are two ways that blood returns to your heart through a vein, even though veins don't have much pressure by themselves altogether. Okay, so if you're sitting still for a long period of time, like maybe 16 hours or 20 hours, something like that, and you don't move any muscles, guess what? The skeletal muscle pump isn't working. That means blood is going to pool in some part of your body, which means what? You're at risk of a blood clot, right? And so have you ever sat anywhere for a really long period of time like that without hardly ever moving? Yeah, like for instance, maybe you're on a jet airliner going to Hong Kong, Denpasar, Perth, Australia, right? And you're just sitting in your airplane seat for hours and hours and hours at an end, right? It's always a fantastic idea to get up and walk around a little bit, okay? Just to keep what? Sounds silly. Maybe it's even what your mother told you. Just to keep your blood circulating, right? And that is really true. Okay. Okay, here's a little thought question. Here we have a vein, right? So here we have, come on, cursor. Here we have a vein. It's going to return to the heart. And this is a nice systemic vein. What part of the heart is it going to return to? What? Okay, how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
Okay. And so which one of those four is this blood going to go to when it returns to the heart? The right atrium, exactly right. So you should have that really familiar, right? And then from the right atrium, just tell me the next chamber. Tell me the valve. What valve does it have to go by? Tricuspid valve, and then into what chamber? The right ventricle. From the right ventricle, where does it go? The pulmonary circulation, right? And there are pulmonary capillaries. And so when you get a blood clot in a systemic vein, that's the area that usually has that thrombus lodged, right? So we call that a pulmonary embolism, and pulmonary embolisms are just as dangerous and deadly as a stroke or a heart attack, okay? All right, so usually the lungs filter out those clots before they can even get to the brain or the heart, but what filters them out are the capillaries in the lungs, and that's really not much of a trade-off. That doesn't really help you out very much. All right, so that's it for this chapter. Unless somebody has a question. Anybody have a question on this chapter right here? Yeah. Yeah. No, you can't reverse it. Because the connective tissue is all stretched out, the endothelium is stretched out. I'm not really up on the current therapies for deep vein thrombosis, but for varicose veins, if it's really bad, they just remove them. Okay. They just take those veins out. But, of course, we can't do that with all the blood vessels in your body, all the veins in your body. Yeah. The artery portion. Where was that? Did I talk about this last time? Maybe. Oh, you know what? I think I probably told you guys that arteries are some... Most of this you have to know on your own. Okay. But let me just look through this. All right, so structure of blood vessel, any kind of blood vessel, right? That there's a tunica externa, right? A media and interna. And some of these layers have skeletal muscle, some have elastic tissues, some have connective tissues. So all blood vessels, whether it's a vein or an artery, have all three of these different layers, right? A tunic is just a coat. But there's one kind of blood vessel that does not have three layers. These three layers, and that is a capillary, because a capillary has to be really thin. The capillary only has the tunica interna or intima, and it only has an endothelium, so it's small. It doesn't have any connective tissue, no elastic tissue, no smooth muscle. It's just very, very, very thin. All right, but arteries, all right, what kind of pressure is in an artery? High or low? High, right, and you saw it was very low in veins. So arteries do have to have a lot of muscle, smooth muscle around, a lot of connective tissue, and arteries that are very close to the heart have to have elastic tissues in them as well, because when the heart contracts, a whole big bolus of blood gets forced into the aorta, and it has to expand a little bit. And then as that blood drains to the rest of your body, guess what happens to that bulge in the aorta? It just comes right back to the normal size of an aorta because of what kind of protein? Elastin, right? That elastic protein. All right, so some arteries, we call these conducting arteries close to the heart. They do expand during systole, and then they go back or recoil during diastole. And sometimes that can kind of help smooth out blood flow through other parts of the body. Okay, other kinds of arteries. Here we have an artery, and of course you got to know what the definition of an artery is. What's a good definition of an artery?
Just
It's the only thing that works. Yeah, it's some kind of vessel that takes blood away from the heart, and it can be high in oxygen or low in oxygen, depending on what circulation it is. In this particular illustration, I see it says an artery right here, and it's colored red. So is this a systemic or pulmonary artery? Systemic, right? Because it's high in oxygen. A pulmonary artery is going to be low in oxygen, and it would be colored blue. All right, so here we have an artery, and there are branches off an artery. Small arteries are what we call arterioles, and arterioles do have smooth muscle around them. And this is where most of the resistance in blood flow occurs, is in small arteries that we call arterioles, and they can vasoconstrict and vasodilate. And also, there's a special smooth muscle at the entrance to every capillary bed. We call that a pre-capillary sphincter. So here's a capillary. What's special about this network right here? Yeah, exchange can take place, right? And so this can bring in nutrients. For instance, let's just pick a muscle. Maybe this is in a muscle someplace. So this capillary can bring in nutrients to a muscle, and it can take away carbon dioxide, can bring oxygen. So when should we have blood going through this capillary right here? When the muscle is just sitting there, or when the muscle is working? Okay, when does the muscle need oxygen and glucose? When it's working, right? So there is not enough blood to go everywhere in your body at one time. So blood vessels in different parts of the body have to figure out where blood should go. So when a muscle is not contracting, this pre-capillary sphincter is constricted, and that prevents blood from going into this capillary bed, so it is shunted from the artery directly into the venous return to the heart. Right? And when that muscle starts to exercise, right, then this precapillary sphincter dilates, and so a bunch of oxygen enters the muscle, glucose enters, carbon dioxide is taken away. All right, so you should tell me, what controls this precapillary sphincter? It is not a nerve. It's not a nerve. That would be really interesting. But it just responds to the chemicals that it is surrounded with. So when a muscle isn't working, what can you tell me about ATP? Should it be high or low? ATP. Muscle's not working, so ATP should be really high. It's not being used up. Okay, a muscle's not working, what should oxygen concentration be, high or low? It should be high because muscle isn't working. What about CO2 concentration when a muscle is not working? Now that should be low, right? What about glucose? Should be high. What about lactic acid when a muscle is not working? Yeah, remember where lactic acid is? How would you describe where lactic acid is produced by somebody or a particular tissue? Under what kind of conditions? Anaerobic conditions. And when is a muscle in anaerobic condition? When it's contracted, right? When that muscle is a big solid mass like that, blood can't even get into it, right? So it has to operate under anaerobic conditions, producing lactic acid. So lactic acid, ATP, ADP concentrations, CO2 and oxygen will regulate the constriction, the amount of constriction of this precapillary sphincter. So if oxygen is high, that will cause constriction. If CO2 is high, that will cause vasodilation. If there's ADP, that's going to cause vasodilation, so that will bring in oxygen and mitochondria can make ATP out of it. So when you have a smooth muscle like this precapillary sphincter, and it's not controlled by the nervous system, it's just controlled by the chemicals in its immediate neighborhood, we call that, and I do want you to know this is pretty important, or even later on, we call that local control. I'm not sure it's in your book, so make sure you make a nice note of that. Local control is when metabolites or other kinds of chemicals adjust the properties of a smooth muscle controlling blood flow through a particular tissue. Okay, so if it's a compound that shouldn't be in that muscle, then that compound is going to cause vasodilation. And if that muscle is completely filled up with oxygen and ATP, then this precapillary sphincter should constrict because that muscle doesn't need blood flow. That's local control. Yeah. Local control. So here we have, can you see that smooth muscle right here, that precapillary sphincter? Okay. There is not a nerve fiber that goes there. to control the smooth muscle, but it will contract, causing a decreased blood flow through this capillary. What controls the state of vasoconstriction is just the kinds of chemicals that surround that muscle, right? Just the locality, chemicals in the locality of that muscle. So things that represent muscle activity, right, would be what? Maybe ADP concentration increasing, CO2 increasing, lactic acid increasing, which means then the acidity is decreasing, or the acidity, or the pH is decreasing. That's going to cause vasodilation of this precapillary sphincter, so blood can get into that particular muscle that is exercising. But if it's a muscle in the middle of the night that's not exercising, it doesn't need a lot of blood supply, right? Because it doesn't need to regenerate a lot of ATP. It's filled with ATP. And it doesn't need to get rid of CO2 because it's not producing CO2. Under those circumstances, right, this precapillary sphincter is going to be constricted so that blood hardly even goes to this capillary. So when chemicals in the local neighborhood control the state of vasoconstriction or vasodilation of that capillary via the precapillary sphincter, we call that local control. So maybe I should jot some things down. All right, so we got ATP, oxygen, what else? Glucose. All right, so if all these things are floating around that precapillary sphincter, what's the result on that precapillary sphincter? You're going to call that vasoconstriction. Because blood doesn't need to get to that muscle because it has everything it needs. But if there's ADP, what does that mean? ATP has been broken down, right? And you're left over with ADP, not quite as much energy. CO2, and what about lactate? What is that going to do? That's going to cause vasodilation. And when that vasodilates, when the capillary vasodilates and blood can flow into that muscle, and when it does, what's it going to do? It's going to get rid of this stuff, and it's going to bring in this stuff. Right? So that's the interesting thing about local control. And what the circulation is this? Are we talking about specifically? Actually, I do want you to know that, too. How many sides does the heart have? Two, right and left. How many circulations do you have? Two. And what are the names of the two circulations? Systemic and pulmonary. And I'm specifically talking about systemic circulation right here. Systemic circulation. And you could probably guess what local control looks like in the pulmonary circulation, because remember, the pulmonary circulation typically is always what? Opposite compared to systemic. So when we get to respiratory chapter, I do want you to become familiar with that concept of local control. And that produces a lot of disease for us, actually, in the lungs. Okay, so that's, I think, all I want you to know about arteries. And the big concept there is local control, right, at that precapillary sphincter. Okay, who's got some more questions on that? Anybody have a question about arteries? No, if you want to look at those different layers, there's probably pictures in your textbook or get your anatomy textbook out. But that's mostly just anatomy, not so much physiology. Okay, cardiac output, blood flow, blood pressure. Well, we got an equation right here. Blood flow this you just have to memorize, and you should be familiar with this, right? If you increase the pressure, it's going to increase flow from one place to another. But if you introduce some kind of resistance, that's going to reduce blood flow. So this is a very intuitive kind of equation, and it's a really simple equation. Right? All right, but what is blood flow? In terms of the units, what is blood flow? Blood flow is a volume per time. So it's an amount of blood that is moving for a certain unit of time. So it's not a speed. It's not a distance per time, but it's a volume per time. So what would that be like? That would be like mLs per minute. That would be a pretty good example of the units that we would use to describe blood flow, right? Because a milliliter is cubic centimeter. So that is a flow moving. Okay. And I will show you how it relates to units right here. But make sure you know that this is blood flow as opposed to speed. What are the units in speed? So speed would be what? I think you should probably know this. Speed is going to be equal to what? Distance. Yeah, not volume, but just plain old distance. And we could say per time. And you could say minute. That's not how speed is measured in your car. How's speed measured in your car? Miles per hour. Right? We could rewrite it into centimeters per minute, but we're not so interested in doing that. Okay, so that is flow. All right, so what is flow? Cardiac output is blood flow. And blood flow is blood flow. Blood pressure is not blood flow, but it influences blood flow. So these are some of the things we're going to look at in this particular chapter. Cardiac output, all right, is a flow of blood out of the heart. And in particular, and when we say flow, it's what? A volume of blood pumped per every minute by each ventricle. And the right ventricle and left ventricle should be pumping about the same amount every time, right? Because otherwise, blood is going to pool in the pulmonary circulation or systemic circulation, and that's not a good thing, right? Blood should just be pumped equally by both ventricles. So here is a concept called stroke volume. Your heart doesn't pump blood all the time. Sometimes it's pumping, sometimes it's relaxing. When is it pumping blood? Under what phase? Yeah, systole, right? And during diastole, it's not pumping any blood whatsoever. So it's sort of like a reciprocating pump. We would like to know how much blood is pumped every time it beats. That will tell us something about how good the heart is functioning. We call that the stroke volume, right? Stroke volume, every time the heart beats, pumps out a certain volume of blood, and so we're going to measure stroke volume in milliliters, like millimeters per beat, right, every time the heart beats. And from that, we can understand what the cardiac output is, what the flow of blood out of the heart is, okay? And so what is cardiac output? It is the stroke volume, and what is that? The amount that the heart beats every time, pumps out every time. So let's see if I can write this over here. What do we got? Cardiac, oh no, I want to write it right here. All right. So cardiac output is equal to stroke volume times heart rate. So what is stroke volume in terms of units? It is, for instance, milliliters per beat. Beat. And what's heart rate? What are the units of heart rate? You're counting, and you counted something, and now you want to tell me what it is? It is? Yeah. So it is beats per minute. Okay, so what can you tell me if we multiply these things, two things together like we are for stroke volume and heart rate? What happens to the beats? They cancel out, and you have milliliters per minute. So that is what? Milliliter is a volume. What kind of unit is minute? Time, what does that remind you of? Oh, right here, which is what? A blood flow. So cardiac output really is blood flow, but it is blood flow out of the heart. And so you can see that it's regulated by these two parameters, stroke volume, which is related to the force of contraction, and heart rate. What is heart rate related to? How many times it contracts, right? So there's two ways to think about the efficiency of the heart. Okay, cardiac output equals stroke volume times heart rate. Good. Okay, so since we have a rate and a strength, we talk about regulating the heart in those two different ways. They're different from each other. So when the heart rate is adjusted, we call that a chronotropic effect or chronotropy, right? Like the watch like the timepiece you have on your arm is called a chronograph sometimes if it's a really fancy watch. All right, so chronotropy has to do with heart rate. And remember, without any kind of nervous innervation on the heart will just beat by itself because it has rhythmic properties. And what is the place on the heart that regulates the heart rate or can actually control the heart rate if there are no nerves going to the heart? Yeah, the SA node. And we saw that there were special proteins in the membranes that allow for spontaneous depolarization at the SA node. And when that depolarization reaches threshold, then the heart is going to beat because that produces an action potential all over the whole heart via those gap junctions. Okay, so can anybody remember what those channels are called that allow for that spontaneous depolarization? It's a sodium channel, and in particular, it's called the HCN channel, okay, which allow for spontaneous depolarization. So normally, sympathetic and parasympathetic activity influence the heart rate because both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves go to the SA node, right? And so sympathetic, parasympathetic is autonomic innervation, and so that's the main controller of heart rate. So what is the effect of sympathetic, increasing sympathetic tone on the SA node? So if you think of sympathetic, which one should you think of, fight or flight or rest and digest? Yeah, fight or flight. Just think of that. It's a really handy way, right? So fight or flight, your heart rate is going to increase. So sympathetic increases. You also know that parasympathetic is antagonistic to sympathetic. So parasympathetic is going to slow the heart rate down. Okay. All right. So how does it do that? Let's take a look at this slide right here. Okay, so here are those, so don't forget, the SA node has these HCN channels, and so I see an action potential here, right? So when the membrane potential depolarizes to threshold, that produces an action potential. Now, what kind of action potential does this look like? Does that look like from a nerve fiber or from a contractile cell in the heart or a nodal cell in the heart? So when you look at this, you should probably be able to recognize that, okay? And what about a contractile cell in the heart? What does it have? It has a very special signature. The contractile cell has this big, long plateau region due to calcium channels, right? And then it repolarizes. So we're in the heart. There's no plateau region, so it can't be a contractile cell. This is a nodal cell. And nodal cells have these HCN channels that produce depolarization, right? So here is, I guess we could call this resting membrane potential, but remember, the membrane potential is never really at rest because it spontaneously depolarizes because of these HCN channels. So these cells start to depolarize, and when they get here, what happens? Then there's an action potential, right? And then it repolarizes, and then because of the HCN channels, it spontaneously depolarizes, and that causes another action potential. And so remember, all the cells in the heart have these gap junctions, so this action potential not only travels over the whole surface of that one cell, but where does it go? It goes all over the heart, right? So that it contracts as a unit. Okay. With sympathetic stimulation, let's look at the slope of this spontaneous depolarization. It gets a lot steeper, and since it's a lot steeper, it means that those HCN channels are these are just sodium-gated channels that open up, so sodium leaves the cell, a lot more sodium leaves the cell, so the slope of depolarization is a lot steeper, reaches threshold a lot sooner. Right? Can you tell that the second circumstance here is where it would be compared to the control action potential, right? So under sympathetic stimulation, the heart rate increases because sodium enters the cell much more quickly. And that's due to norepinephrine on the heart. And epinephrine will have the same effect too, right? But neurotransmitter from the sympathetic nervous system is going to adjust the rate of depolarization through those sodium channels so that the heart rate increases. All right, so that's sympathetic. What's the other one that we have to look at? Parasympathetic, right? It slows the heart rate down. How does it do that? All right, so here I see depolarization, not quite as quick as the control circumstance or under sympathetic activity. Right, the slope is a lot shallower, takes longer to get to threshold, so the heart rate decreases. Right, so how can you prevent depolarization? What's a nice molecular way that you have in your mind that you can prevent depolarization? Right, we want to add to depolarization, which is sodium leaving the cell. How could you slow that process down? Okay, maybe a couple ways, closing some of those sodium channels, so sodium can't enter the cell. But what's a way that you repolarize the cell? with potassium, right? So acetylcholine or parasympathetic stimulation, right, will open up some potassium channels along with the HCN channel. So sodium is going in, potassium is going out. That slows the rate of the spontaneous depolarization, so the heart rate is extended as a result of that, right, because of that potassium causing that hyperpolarization. Added together with depolarization, it just slows this rate down. Okay, so on this slide, you should recognize these as an action potential from a nodal cell. And under what circumstances? All right, so here's a slow heart rate. Slow heart rate is due to parasympathetic stimulation. Fast heart rate is due to sympathetic stimulation. All right, and we've actually looked at all these fancy things because all of these, right, when they are acted upon by norepinephrine or acetylcholine, oh, what do we call a receptor for norepinephrine? What kind of receptor is that? And I don't even want a specific kind. I don't want the subclassification. I just want the overall general classification. That's called an adrenergic receptor. Okay, so we have adrenergic receptors on the heart. And guess what? You could probably tell me what kind of adrenergic receptor right now. But let's not go there right now. And the acetylcholine receptors. All right, what do we call an acetylcholine receptor? Yeah, cholinergic, right? And so it's not a nicotinic receptor because that's just a straight old ion channel that opens up. But this cholinergic receptor is a G protein coupled receptor, which is a muscarinic receptor. The receptor for norepinephrine is also a G protein coupled receptor, right? But it's a beta adrenergic receptor. So you have beta adrenergic versus muscarinic cholinergic receptor right here. So you can have antagonistic effects. All right, so besides rate of contraction, what else do we have in cardiac output? What else regulates the flow, cardiac output from the heart? It is the strength of contraction. We call that stroke volume, the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats. So if the heart is stronger and it beats, guess what? It's going to pump more blood out. So the stroke volume goes up. Stroke volume increases with sympathetic stimulation. So we're going to look at that. But what can you tell me about the relationship between heart rate and cardiac output? If I increase heart rate, what happens to cardiac output? It increases because why? It is directly related, right? If you increase heart rate, cardiac output goes up. What's the relationship of stroke volume to cardiac output? If we increase stroke volume, what happens to cardiac output? It increases because it's also directly related. If both of these go up, then of course cardiac output goes up much quicker because they're both directly related. Okay, so force of contraction, mostly this term right here, has nothing to do with heart rate, but stroke volume. We call that inotropy, force of contraction, or contractility. Sometimes we call that contractility, right? But inotropy is the force of contraction. The place in your body that controls that is the cardioregulatory center. That's what I like to call it. I think your book maybe calls it cardio control center, right? That's in the medulla, and it controls autonomic innervation to the heart, in particular sympathetic nerve endings. The sympathetic nerves go to the atria, like we just saw. When they go to the atria, they go to the SA node. And when they go to the SA node, what are those nerve fibers affecting? Stroke volume or heart rate? When it goes to the SA node, heart rate, it only affects over here, okay? But those sympathetic nerve fibers also go to the muscles of the atria and muscles of the ventricle and cause them to increase force of contraction. All right, so sympathetic stimulation can increase heart rate as well as stroke volume. The heart contracts more strongly. So what happens to cardiac output under sympathetic stimulation? Since both SV and HR go up, cardiac output goes up as well. Okay. All right, so make sure you know the difference between an inotropic effect and a chronotropic effect. Now, the heart is not always dually innervated. I pointed that out to you when we were looking at the autonomic nervous system, and this seems really strange because antagonistic control is really a good thing because it provides for precise control and balance. Right? But the heart is not controlled that way. Not the whole heart anyway. So here we have some regions of the heart in the first column. Second column is sympathetic effects from increasing or decreasing sympathetic tone. And the third column is parasympathetic nerve effects. So let's look at one region, the SA node. There are sympathetic nerves that go there as well as parasympathetic nerves. So what's the effect of sympathetic stimulation on the SA node? Increase heart rate, all right, because it's adjusting the slope of that spontaneous depolarization. Parasympathetic nerves go there, and what does that do? That slows the heart rate down because it decreases the slope of that spontaneous depolarization of those nodal tissues. All right. Same thing for the AV node. Sympathetic nerves increase the conduction rate of nerve impulses through the AV node. Remember that AV node is a little site where the depolarization or the action potential is delayed. It's held for a little bit before given to the ventricle, so that makes sure the atria contract first and then the ventricles. That happens at the AV node. Right, so sympathetic stimulation increases conduction at the AV node, and parasympathetic decreases, a nice antagonistic effect. Now let's look at muscle. Now we're not looking at nodal tissue anymore, but in particular muscle, atrial muscle and ventricular muscle. Are there any parasympathetic nerves that go to muscle in the heart? Look over here. No, no significant effect, which means there are no parasympathetic nerves that go to the heart muscle, only the nodal tissues in the heart. So parasympathetic stimulation can have no effect on inotropy of the heart, the force of contraction. Only sympathetic nerves can increase the strength of contraction, right? And sympathetic nerves do what? They increase strength, both of the atria and the ventricles. That's just a single innervation. It's not dual innervation from the autonomic nervous system. All right, so sympathetic stimulation can affect the rate. What's another better way of saying rate? It is the chronotropy of the heart. So sympathetic can affect chronotropy. And what else can it affect? Inotropy. That's right. And a really good way of thinking of this is that sympathetic stimulation has a positive chronotropic effect and a positive inotropic effect on the heart. What about parasympathetic? Decreases the rate, has no effect on force of contraction. So parasympathetic stimulation has a negative, what kind of effect? Negative chronotropic effect. It slows the heart rate down, but it has no effect on inotropy of the heart one way or the other. All right, so make sure you can break the heart down into force of contraction and rate of contraction, which you see really nicely in this cardiac output equation. Right? Here's force, here's rate. Inotropy, chronotropy, right there. All right. All right, well, we need to look at stroke volume a little bit more to understand some dynamics of your cardiovascular system. Let's talk about these three variables. Some of these you've already dealt with, maybe even for that exam, and that is end-diastolic volume. What the heck is end-diastolic volume? It's the volume inside of a ventricle at what time? Well, it says right in the name, right at end diastole. And what's diastole? Is that when the heart contracts or relaxed? It's relaxed. So is end diastolic volume the small volume of the heart in the heart cycle or the large volume? Yeah, it's the large volume. After the heart has filled up maximally, that's the end diastolic volume, because what happens after that point is systole, and then the volumes are going to start to change. They're going to decrease, right? So end diastolic volume is just the amount of blood that is available for the heart to pump. The other thing that happens, as blood flows into a ventricle, guess what happens to it? I don't have blood flowing. My hands are forming a little chamber right here. My hands aren't changing volume at all. So is blood, could blood be flowing into my hands like this, this chamber that my hands are making? If blood flows in, what has to happen? It has to get bigger. Yeah, it's got to get bigger. So that means the walls of the ventricles or the atria stretch, right? All right, so end-diastolic volume means that the atria are stretching. The bigger this end-diastolic volume, the more the walls of the heart are stretched. All right, so we'll leave that there for now. TPR, total peripheral resistance, right, is the resistance to blood flow in all of the blood vessels of your body. In particular, let's just think of the systemic circulation. So in terms of this equation right here, blood flow is equal to pressure and resistance. Where would TPR fall into this equation here? Yeah, it's resistance, right? So if we increase total peripheral resistance, if we increase resistance, what happens to blood flow if pressure stays the same? What happens to blood flow if resistance increases? Yeah, it decreases because it's inversely related. All right, so just kind of think of that for a moment. Myocardial contractility, that is just the strength of ventricular contraction, and it's most directly related to what? Stroke volume, the amount of blood that is pumped by the heart every time it beats. All right, so how is stroke volume regulated in the heart? Well, here's a couple things. End-diastolic volume, sometimes we call this the preload. This is the workload on the heart prior to contraction. All right, and stroke volume is going to be directly proportional to the preload and contractility. And we've actually understood why this was already, but we've got to relate it to the heart. All right, so that just means that the strength of contraction, right, because that's the SV term in our cardiac output equation, strength of contraction varies directly with end-diastolic volume. So what's happening to an atrium as end-diastolic volume increases? What happens to an atrium? It starts to expand. It means the walls are stretching. The muscles are stretching as a result of that. And as they stretch, the heart gets stronger up to a point. And I got to show you a figure of that. Okay. The total peripheral resistance, sometimes we call that the afterload. That total peripheral resistance, right, impedes blood flow through the cardiovascular system. And here is another important term. We haven't talked about this one yet. This is ejection fraction. All right, this is a hugely important number that you're going to hear about all the time because when we know, well, let me tell you what it is, and then I'll tell you why it's important. Ejection fraction is just the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart compared to how much blood was in the heart to begin with. All right, so the heart, that's one important function of the heart. Let's just say that the heart ventricle has 1 liter of blood in it, and when it contracts, it pumps out almost a whole liter of blood. That means the heart is functioning really, really well, right? As compared to a heart, once you put a liter of blood in it and it contracts and it only pumps out 5 milliliters, what could you tell me about that heart? Not pumping very well, right? And so we want to come up with a term that can describe that very conveniently, and that is ejection fraction. Ejection fraction is how much blood is pumped out of the heart every time it beats compared to how much blood was in the heart before it started to contract. Right? And that's ejection fraction. That's a percentage because both of these are volumes. Maybe you could think of this almost as hematocrit. Right? Hematocrit was the number of red blood cells compared to the volume of all blood components. Right? Ejection fraction just tells us how well the heart is functioning, and usually it's about 60%. Right? When you have heart disease, guess what happens to this 60%? You think it goes up or down? It goes down, goes to 50, goes to 40, and it gets to a point, right, 40, maybe 30, you'll never get the heart back. So this ejection fraction is really a nice thing to know to time surgery. If you need a valve replacement or other kind of surgeries on the heart, right, you never want it to get below a certain point because then there's nothing you can do for somebody. Of course, no one will ever tell you that. We don't ever want to accept that in medicine, but that happens. So that's a really important number. Okay. Well, you've heard of, so what I want to talk about now, let me tell you this. Strength of contraction varies with end-diastolic volume. That's what I want to deal with right now. The next slide shows that, and we see Frank Starling law of the heart. And I think we talked about the Frank Starling law already. No, we talked about length-tension relationships in skeletal muscle. Can anybody remember what happens to the skeletal muscle when we start to stretch it out? Not completely, but we start to stretch it. What happens to the skeletal muscle? Is the force of contraction the same? Does it get stronger? Does it get weaker? You know what? It actually gets a little bit stronger as we start to stretch it out. Okay. Same thing for the heart. Let's look at this graph. So we have a graph of stroke volume. That's really the efficiency of how the heart is working, how much blood the heart is pumping out, versus the end-diastolic volume, which is a way of understanding how stretched out the ventricle is. And look what happens. As we stretch out the ventricle, what happens to contractility? Let's just look at this bottom graph right here. All right, so if we stretch out the ventricle, what happens to stroke volume or the force of contraction? Does it go up or does it go down? Or does it stay constant? Clearly, it goes up, right? So end-diastolic volume, when end-diastolic volume increases, the force of contraction increases. Is that what? So here's a graph that says what? Strength of contraction varies directly with end-diastolic volume, right? So they're directly related to each other. And under sympathetic activity, norepinephrine, guess what happens to this curve? It gets shifted to the left. So at any one particular end-diastolic volume, let's just pick this one right here. Here is without sympathetic nerve stimulation. Here is with some sympathetic nerve stimulation. Which one of these conditions does the heart contract more strongly? Where I have the cursor right now, condition 1 or condition 2. And you would tell that by just looking at the number over here on the stroke volume axis, right? So the stroke volume is much greater under sympathetic stimulation compared to under normal conditions, right, by that much. And so that just demonstrates that sympathetic activity does increase force of contraction. Okay. And notice, we're not talking about, well, in one curve, like this curve right here, this is independent of any kind of nerve stimulation. This is just a property of the heart itself. As the heart starts to expand, this is really nice. As the heart starts to expand, more blood is presented to it, and guess how the heart responds? It gets stronger. So that's a really nice intrinsic property of the heart. And that's what we see on this Frank-Starling law. This is what we call the ascending limb of the Frank-Starling law. And what would happen to the force of contraction of this heart if this end-diastolic volume decreased, if we went back down in this direction? What happens to the force of contraction? It goes down, right, because it's directly related. As the ventricles fill up with blood, it gets stronger. When it doesn't fill up with blood so much, the heart gets weaker. That's the downside of the Frank-Starling law. But Frank-Starling law usually works well for us. Okay. So I guess I'd want to draw one other thing out over here. We don't need this anymore. So this is a huge property that you should be aware of. What? Frank-Starling? Frank-Starling law. And Frank-Starling law, what are our axes right here? This is stroke volume. One way of thinking about that is contractility, strength of contraction. So maybe I'll put contractility right here, stroke volume. And then over here, we're going to compare that with end-diastolic volume. And what's end-diastolic volume really? It's the stretch. Stretch of the muscle fibers of the heart. And from what I'm showing on the projector, right, if end-diastolic volume is zero, okay, there's no blood in the heart, and the heart isn't stretched at all, the muscles aren't stretched, then it won't produce any force. As we start to fill the heart with blood, the ventricles, the muscle starts to stretch, right, and what happens to the force of contraction? It increases, right, just like what we see over here. Reaches, of course it doesn't reach an infinite level of strength, okay, but it kind of plateaus out a little bit at some maximum value. And then if we start to stretch the heart even more, guess what happens to the force of contraction? It goes down. So that's really the Frank-Starling law. It's got an ascending limb and a descending limb and an optimal condition right here where it produces the most strength. All right, so why is this important? Well, when would end-diastolic volume decrease when it goes this way and put us into this region where the heart is starting to fail? When would end-diastolic volume decrease? Well, how about you're walking down the sidewalk, riding a motorcycle, and your femoral artery is lacerated. And so instead of all that blood in your blood vessels going back to your heart, where is it going? It's just running down the sidewalk, right? So it's not going back to the heart. The heart is not stretching. What happens to the force of contraction under hemorrhage conditions? Yeah, the heart is beginning to fail because of the Frank-Starling law of the heart. So, okay, so here we have like bleeding. What would we want to do?
And that's terrible when somebody's heart is failing, right? How could we get somebody's heart function back really quickly? Well, first you got to stop the bleeding, right? But what else could we do? What do we want to do? We want to get their heart operating back over here at a proper end diastolic volume. We would transfuse them, okay? And it doesn't even have to be blood, right? It could be saline. Anything that increases blood volume means the heart is going to stretch. If it's over here, when the heart stretches, guess what happens to it? It gets stronger, right? So that's really, really handy. Under other conditions, maybe somebody is retaining too many fluids, right? And their blood volume goes way up and the heart begins to stretch, right? And you start operating over here, for instance, the descending limb. The heart is getting weaker and weaker and weaker because the heart is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, how could we help somebody here? How could we reduce their blood volume? Everybody's familiar with this. We could give them a diuretic. All right, and so for high blood pressure, when somebody's heart starts to dilate like this, one of the first therapies that somebody is given is a diuretic, and then you lose blood volume, and that brings your heart back to normal. And that's almost like a miracle drug. Somebody can be in terrible heart failure, and just with a bit of diuretic, they can come right back magically, maybe even within a couple of hours. So that's the importance of this Frank-Starling law, okay? All right, so molecularly, how can we think of this thing? Well, what's the structural and functional unit of contraction in skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle? It's a sarcomere, right? So let's think of a sarcomere. Here's a sarcomere. I can see the Z discs, right? I can see a thick filament, thin filament. The thin filaments or actin are bound to the Z discs, and the myosin is right smack in the middle. And we can stretch the sarcomere out, or we can not stretch it out like I see down over here and look at conditions in between. All right, so here we have a sarcomere that's not stretched out at all. All right, so the end diastolic volume, what's end diastolic volume if the sarcomere is not stretched out at all? It's going to be very low, right? It's going to be very low end diastolic volume. So I see really nice overlap between actin and myosin, so cross bridges can form. But notice that the Z discs are right up against the myosin molecules. So can this sarcomere shorten? It's as short as it can be right now, right? Even though cross bridges are forming, so it might be able to produce a little tension, but because it can't shorten, it can't produce a whole lot of tension. So what is that muscle going to look like? It's going to look like this. All right, so here's a measure of tension versus time. So we get that muscle to twitch. It produces a little bit of tension, just like that. Okay, and then it relaxes. Now let's stretch that muscle. Let's go to condition B. So do we still have plenty of overlap between actin and myosin? Because we have to form cross bridges, right? There has to be overlap. Do you see good overlap between actin and myosin? Yeah, it's really great. All right, and look, I'm sorry, look right over. So there's plenty of overlap, and the sarcomere can shorten a little bit. And under those conditions, then the sarcomere here can produce more tension than the first case because case A, the sarcomere can't shorten, right? Sarcomere B can shorten, so the force of contraction is a little bit stronger as what? The muscle is stretched. And when does the muscle stretch? When end diastolic volume increases. All right, let's go all the way to this last case. So let's put a lot of blood into the ventricle, and that really stretches out the sarcomeres. And in this particular case, there's still really nice, there's really good overlap between actin and myosin, but now we see that there is a large distance that this sarcomere can shorten. So when this sarcomere is stretched out, it can produce the most tension. All right, so that's just a nice way to think about the Frank-Starling law, just by optimal overlap of actin and myosin molecules and how much this particular sarcomere can shorten. And if it can't shorten, it can't produce a lot of tension. What's not drawn on this slide right here, let's go back to the top sarcomere. Let's stretch this muscle out some more. What would happen if we stretch it out even twice this length? Is it going to get stronger still? Let's really stretch that sarcomere out to twice this length. Well, then guess what? There's not going to be any overlap between actin and myosin because you've stretched out the sarcomere so much. And then what happens to the force that's produced by that sarcomere where there's no overlap of actin and myosin? It's not going to contract at all, right? And so then you have going the other way, right? Then you're on that descending limb of the Frank-Starling curve. So it's really nice to have a good idea of sarcomeres and how contractility of the heart works. Okay, so that is intrinsic control of the heart, right? That's just due to how these sarcomeres are built. That's intrinsic control. Of course, there is extrinsic control of contractility. That means influenced by hormones or nerve activity through the heart. So at any given end-diastolic volume, contraction depends on sympathetoadrenal tone or activity. All right, so any kind of sympathetic effect is going to have a positive inotropic effect on the heart, which means it's going to, oh, here it says positive inotropic effect. That's going to increase force of contraction, and because those beta 1 receptors, right, will release calcium into the sarcomeres. And what do you know about calcium, and how does that play into control of contraction? What does calcium do? It's got to bind to something. Yeah, it's going to bind to troponin. That's going to get tropomyosin out of the way. That's going to allow more cross bridges, right? So sympathetic tone increases calcium in sarcomeres, which is going to increase force of contraction because you just have more cross bridges that can form, right? That's a positive inotropic effect. And you remember that to be a G-protein coupled receptor system. So if we look at this curve, relative tension versus the length of a muscle, right over here, and here is a case of cardiac muscle, kind of under resting conditions, under no sympathetic release like norepinephrine or epinephrine. Right? If we introduce norepinephrine onto the heart, guess what happens to this curve? Right? Even at a certain length, right, the heart, okay, will produce a stronger contraction. That's what this is saying. So epinephrine is a positive chronotropic effect, and we can see that skeletal muscle is really not affected at all by sympathetic activity. Okay, so the shift in this curve just shows increased force of contraction at a particular muscle length. And so that's extrinsic control of the heart, because that extrinsic control either comes from the adrenal medulla or from a sympathetic nerve someplace. So here's a pretty handy equation, which I wrote on the board right here. Cardiac output is equal to stroke volume times heart rate. And this has pretty much everything that we talked about in lecture today. All right, so we got blood flow is equal to chronotropy times inotropy. Chronotropy is the heart rate. Inotropy is the force of contraction. So what can affect the heart rate? Can sympathetic nerves affect heart rate? Absolutely. What about parasympathetic? Yeah, absolutely. They both go to the SA node, right? Parasympathetic is going to have a negative chronotropic effect. That's probably what this dotted line means, negative. The solid line means increased chronotropic effect. So sympathetic activity, for sure, increases heart rate. What about force of contraction or stroke volume? Notice that sympathetic nerves don't go to cardiac muscle, so it can't influence contractility, can't influence inotropy on the heart one way or the other. Only sympathetic stimulation can. So sympathetic nerves increase strength of contraction, that increases stroke volume, right? And also, the arterial pressure is going to increase. That means that end-diastolic volume is going to go up, and as we stretch the heart out more, usually we're operating under normal circumstances right around here. So if we begin to stretch the heart out a little more, does our heart get weaker or stronger? It gets a little bit stronger, right? So if all of a sudden our heart stretches out a little bit, it gets stronger to deal with that load, and then it goes back down to here. Okay, so this is going to be an extra credit drawing figure, and it's going to be modified just a little bit. I got to put just a couple other things on there. Okay. I will email it to you. I'll email you that figure. All right, before we go, okay, let's look a little bit more detail on this venous return to the heart. So as blood is returning to the heart, what is it doing? It's starting to stretch, right? The end-diastolic volume increases. What happens to force of contraction? as end-diastolic volume increases in the normal heart, not the diseased heart, but as the ventricles dilate, the heart gets stronger, right? That's the Frank Starling law we have over here. So venous return is just the amount of blood that's returning via veins to the heart, and of course that then controls end-diastolic volume, and that means that it changes stroke volume because of the Frank Starling law of the heart. And if you change the stroke volume, what else are you controlling? The cardiac output. Okay? So that's why venous return is so important. So what is that dependent on? What is venous return dependent on? Well, blood volume and venous pressure as well, but blood volume. So if you lose blood, then your end-diastolic volume is going to go down, like we said, under those hemorrhagic conditions over there. Vasoconstriction, maybe we vasoconstrict veins, and that is going to increase when those veins constrict, then veins don't hold as much blood. It's got to go back to the arterial system via the heart, so the heart fills more with blood. We also talked about the skeletal muscle pump and the respiratory pump, bringing blood back to the heart. That increases end-diastolic volume, so let's look at this graph here. End-diastolic volume is what we're all pointing to, and under the normal condition, what does that mean? End-diastolic volume relates to force of contraction, which is going to relate to cardiac output. All right, so breathing, that returns more blood to the heart. That increases diastolic volume. What happens to the heart when that happens? Gets stronger or weaker, or does it stay the same? More blood going back to the heart. Heart gets stronger, right, because then diastolic volume goes up. All right, as far as blood volume goes, we can increase urine. All right, if we increase urine production, that's going to decrease blood volume. And that's going to decrease venous return. That's going to decrease your blood pressure. It's going to decrease end-diastolic volume. If, for some reason, we reduce urine volume, that means that fluid is going to stay in your body. That's going to go back, increase venous return, and that's going to increase end-diastolic volume. That's going to make the heart stronger. Right. And same thing for tissue fluid volume. If we increase that, that will increase venous return. We talked about this over here. What about venous pressure? Venoconstriction, that's just constriction of a vein. Think again of a balloon, okay, that's filled with water, and it's just sitting in your hand. Now grab that balloon and start to squeeze down on it. And that would be like venoconstriction. When you're squeezing down on that balloon, is the pressure changing in that fluid inside the balloon? Yeah, which way is it changing? It's increasing, right? So venoconstriction is going to increase venous return, that's going to help flow, and that's going to increase end-diastolic volume. That venoconstriction is controlled by the sympathetic nervous system. And what else is going to increase venous pressure? Well, if you squeeze on a vein via skeletal muscles, that also is going to increase venous pressure, venous return, and that will increase end-diastolic volume, making the heart stronger as a result of that. Okay. Here is a nice pie chart of where we have blood in our bodies. And I think this is a pretty nice chart. We see where is most of the blood under resting conditions in your body. Well, we got lungs, we got 8% in your heart, systemic arteries, 10% in systemic arteries, that's all. Large veins. Wow. Okay, and if we add small veins, if we just think of systemic veins all over the body, 60% to 70% of your blood is in veins, okay, under normal resting conditions. Very little here. All right, so if there's vasoconstriction and this volume of veins, right, the blood volume in veins decreases, what does that mean? That blood has to go someplace, and it's got to fit into one of these conditions over here, right? So these slices of that pie diagram have to get bigger when the volume of blood in veins decreases. And since these are high capacitance or high compliance vessels, small changes in vasoconstriction can cause large changes in blood volume in other parts of your body, right? And that's going to control force of contraction of the heart. So this is a pretty interesting pie chart, not just because it tells you what the volume of blood is in these different places, but if you know where it's decreasing, you also know where it is increasing, right? Because it's still going to just be one pie. Okay, so let's stop right there. Do I want to do one more thing? I think this is... Yep, that's good. Next time we're going to talk about some other extrinsic mechanisms that control the heart and body volumes, and these are going to be hormones that are in the blood, namely three hormones. All right, so we're going to talk about those hormones. And does a hormone work for a short period of time or a long period of time? Long period of time. What about the nervous system? Short period of time. So we're going to look at control of cardiovascular system over the long term via hormones next time. Long term.